you probably are keenly aware that chapter 27 is an incredibly long chapter for Matthew's gospel. Most of Matthew's chapters are not this long, but this one is indeed long. And so we may get through it tonight, and we may not. Jesus has been tried. Remember, he's had three appearances in court. Three of those are Jewish. Three of those are Roman. To refresh your memory, Jesus is the charge before Jesus in the Rome in the Jewish court was the charge of blasphemy. He had admitted to the high priest that he was indeed Messiah, the Son of God, even quoting from two Old Testament passages to affirm that fact. Well, but when they got to Pilate for the Roman trial, that particular charge was no longer leveled because Pilate wouldn't care at all about blasphemy. So the charge changed to being basically a traitor to the Roman government because the charge now is that he claimed to be the king of the Jews. Now, in one sense, there is continuity between the two charges, because Messiah was understood, at least in many cases, to be a coming king. So they knew that part. But the part that that changed, though, was from being a charge of blasphemy to that being a traitor or a potential threat to the reign and the peace of Rome. So that's what happened. Judas has already done his thing. We've already talked about that. And we pick up at verse 15, where Jesus is before Pilate. To Pilate's credit, he tries to maneuver in a way to get Jesus released. He does do that. But politically speaking, he can't. And we may get to that in just a moment, why that is. So verse 15, now at the feast the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. That was not a practice that was any part of Roman law, but it was something that sometimes rulers of that day would do to kind of curry favor with the people. They could choose someone that was in custody to be released. Surely, it would be Jesus that the crowd would ask to be released. I mean, why wouldn't it be? At that time, there was a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. I want to talk about Barabbas for a minute. That is a compound, that name is a compound word, meaning it's composed of two words. And it does identify him, but it doesn't clearly identify him. What I mean by that, the B-A-R, bar, is a word that means son. You may have heard of a young man when he's 12 years old, between 12 and 13, he has a bar mitzvah. A bar mitzvah is when he becomes the son of the law. So the word bar means son. The next part of that name, or that word, Abbas, would simply be the name of his father. He is son of Abbas. That is his name. Now, one particular manuscript, one of the older ones, has a name prior to Barabbas, and it's Jesus. Now, we think that Jesus is a very rare name, but in the first century, it was a very common name. That's the Greek translation, what we call Jesus. The name in Hebrew is Yeshua. You may be familiar, you almost hear Joshua in that, because that's exactly what it means. It's Joshua. So it's a common name, very common. So Joshua, Yeshua, was a common name for young, or for men, boys of that era. Now you can understand why Barabbas's first name you know, Yeshua, Barabbas, son of Abbas, how that drops out of the text in subsequent copying and whatnot later, to, you know, having the same name refer to both Barabbas and Jesus. But I think it's authentic. And I'll tell you why. I think it's authentic because that heightens the choice. What Jesus do you want? That's what they're asking the crowd. You choose. You have Jesus, son of Abbas, and you've got Jesus the Christ, or the Messiah. Which one do you want? Which one would you like to have released to you? Surely they would choose Jesus the Christ. Now, there's another dynamic going on too, is Jesus spent much of his ministry in Galilee. As a matter of fact, if you'd ever get out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee and point your arm this way, point your arm that way, in between those two arms is where the majority of the Galilean ministry took place. Not all of it, but the much of it. That had to do with the Jews, at least. So he would be incredibly well known in Galilee. But we're not in Galilee. We're in Judea. Jesus, according to John's Gospel, spent time there, but he wouldn't have been as well known there. Now that supposition, if that be the case, would kind of lend credence to how the crowd could be manipulated to want a call for the release of Barabbas and have Jesus crucified. You know, how could a crowd be that fickle? Well, whatever the case, it was. Therefore, when they came together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. So no wool is being pulled over his eyes. He knows what's going on there. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." Now, we don't know the contents of the dream. We don't know if we're talking a nightmare or what she's referring to, but whatever it is, it leaves her pretty rattled. People of yesteryear put a lot of stock in dreams. Dreams were important, and many times they thought that they would receive omens and direction and all kinds of things they would get via a dream. So this puts something in the mind of Pilate that, again, when he gets that from his wife, he's ready to try to work a little harder in getting Jesus released. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." And Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" And they all said to him, "Let him be crucified." His response, Pilate says, the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." Now there's an interesting dynamic that could... Now this is a little bit of sanctified imagination, depending on where Barabbas was actually being held. Barabbas was the one that was supposed to be the one to occupy the middle cross. That's clear. He's an insurrectionist, he's a terrorist, guilty of murder. So that is his fate. Now some have kind of theorized that where Barabbas was held, he would have been close enough to hear the crowd, but not close enough to be able to discern what was being said always. So what he may have, you just do with this what you want. Again, I don't know if this is actually the case or not. But it could very well be that if you were in Barabbas' cell with him, you would have heard his name shouted by the multitude. And then perhaps something else was said, but he couldn't understand it. And then he would hear the shout, "Crucify him." Which could very well be the case. He could have been close enough that he would have heard the crowd, but not able to hear what Pilate had said. So if that imagination is accurate or close to accurate, you can kind of understand maybe the fast, rapid heart rate of Barabbas when he heard the soldiers coming down to get him. Because he thinks he's going to be crucified. And he would have been, if not Jesus was going to end up being the substitute on the cross. I think that works theologically, consistent with why Jesus died. Technically, he became every sinner's substitute. Every sinner was under the condemnation, at you and me too, under the condemnation of the judgment of death. And Jesus is the one that paid the price for that. In other words, he died in our place is not an exaggerated statement. There's a lot of mystery there, to be sure, but he did. Questions or comments? Why didn't Pilate just say, "Phooey on youy," and let him go? Well, he was concerned. Apparently, you kind of get the three strikes and you're out from the Roman government. And he had already two strikes. Meaning that he had already had two uprisings. And a third one would probably indicate that he would lose his position. And so with that in mind, he was in the proverbial between the rock and a hard place. I think the chief priests knew that. They knew they had him. That he would do whatever they demanded. So, verse 24, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." There is an account, an ancient document that suggests, and we don't know if it's true or not, that Pilate was eventually relieved of his position there. And as this account goes, he became obsessed with washing his hands. That he became really OCD about washing his hands. He was always washing his hands. And he was tormented by what took place here. Eventually, as the story goes, and I don't know if it's true or not, but the story affirms that what happened is that eventually he committed suicide by jumping into either a river or lake or something like that and drowned. But he became obsessed with the washing of his hands. So he was signifying before that multitude, I don't think he's guilty. And I'm innocent. So he washed his hands in front of the other people. I'm innocent of this. I am not, guilty of this. The response was, and all the people said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Okay. Again, not to go into all the details that have been discovered over the years. The Jews had a law coming from Deuteronomy that a man could be beaten only with 40 lashes. So the Jews would always say 39. Because if you miscount, you didn't want to strike a man 41 times, because that was breaking the law. So if it was Jews that was going to scourge Jesus, it wouldn't have been it had been 39 lashes. The Romans, though, who would have been the ones doing this, they had no such law. Basically, believe it or not, that the soldier doing the scourging could scourge until he was wore out, when he just got too tired to do it anymore. What he would use was the proverbial cat of nine tails, which would be strips of leather that were attached to a handle, and it would have bone, glass, rock, even metal embedded in it to do the scourging. Perhaps Pilate even thought maybe they'll have compassion on him once he's scourged. I don't know. But at least that was what was attempted, perhaps. Again, comments or questions you might have. I mean, it's nothing you haven't heard before.
I shouldn't be amazed, but the segment always sticks out to me is when they say, "His blood be on us." Okay, but they don't stop there. And on our children, they're actually almost like calling a curse on their own children.
They are.
For the blood of Christ. I think, wow, that's just mind-boggling to me.
And probably that would have been fulfilled in AD 70. When General Titus destroyed Jerusalem. Yes?
Why flog him before they crucify him? There's an implication to his death anyway.
Well, one possibility, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, I've alluded to it, is maybe the crowds would have compassion. But they didn't. But it wasn't uncommon to do that to a man who was condemned to die on a cross. The reason for that is because death on a cross wasn't necessarily very rapid. There were accounts of men languishing on a cross for days before finally dying. So the scourging was to hasten that process.
Wasn't it also part of the prophecies?
Well, Isaiah 53 talks about by his stripes we are healed. Yeah. There's a lot. If you look at different Old Testament passages, you see Zechariah 12 talks about Messiah. Actually, when you look at it, you'll see that it's not about Messiah. It's God himself speaking. Because it's first person pronouns. And said, they will look upon me whom they have pierced. And they will mourn as one mourns for an only son. That is in Zechariah 12. That's bad enough. But see, a part of... You see, The Romans, I've mentioned to you on other occasions that they were keenly... They really enjoyed the idea of the Roman peace, the peace of Rome. But there were ways that they enabled that peace to exist, and that was to be incredibly brutal. And one of the ways that they expressed that was in what they would do in crucifixion. They wanted it to be humiliating. They wanted it to be excruciating. They wanted to be a deterrent. And it was. Because it was, and they did it very publicly so everyone would know it. When you rebel against Rome, this is your fate. Right here. And apparently, when Jerusalem fell under Titus, General Titus in AD 70, along with the Roman army, they just lined the roads with victims of crucifixion. And they left them there. They didn't take them down. They just left the corpses on the crosses to decay, and that everyone walking by or walking close could see that. Adding to the deterrent factor, you rebel, this is what happens. So he scourged. It would be a very... If anybody see Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ? The scourging scene is very accurate. Very accurate. What isn't accurate is the crucifixion scene. Because he has compassion on the audience when you get to the crucifixion scene. It's very mild compared to what it actually was. And we can talk about that too. But the whole point of it is to make something so horrific that no one would dare rebel against Rome. So let's go a little bit further. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus to the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." More humiliation. Then they spat on him and took a reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him and put his own clothes on him and led him away to be crucified. So some of these soldiers that are doing this ill treatment, some of those are probably the crucifixion team that are going to crucify these three individuals on this particular Friday afternoon, or Friday morning now. It's going to extend into the afternoon. Now when they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and compelled him to bear his cross. And when he had come to the place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. Then they crucified him, dividing his garments and casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, "They divided my garments among them, and lots, and for my clothing and casting lots." Actually, the sour wine and the gall was actually a humane thing to do, because it would help. It would be like something to kind of deaden some of the pain. And when Jesus tasted it, he refused to drink it. And then it just says they crucified him. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And they put up over his head the accusation written against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Again, common practice, the charge would be nailed above the head of the victim on the cross. That way, anybody passing by would see what the crime was. Actually, we're also told that it was written in three different languages. It was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, I believe. So everybody passing by that was literate would be able to read what his crime allegedly was. Matter of fact, it upset the religious leaders, because they went to Pilate and said, "No, no, no, don't put that up. Put up that he said that he was King of the Jews." And Pilate, I guess to kind of get his lick in, said simply, "What I have written, I have written." In other words, forget it. I'm not changing it. Again, comments. Yes?
Didn't the gall also tend to weaken the person on the cross so that they would hang and suffocate quicker?
I'm not sure. It was a sedative. I mean, it would not relieve very much pain, probably. I don't know. I hadn't heard that, but it could. Rome, one of the things about the nature of crucifixion, you didn't want it to get over with too quick. You want it to take a while. And that's just for the deterrent factor. Now, there was also something else that you may be totally aware of it. Men that were crucified naked. It suggests that because they're gambling for his clothing. But see, that's one more step of humiliation in the process of executing the man. is, and if especially Jewish men would have found this absolutely horrid, that they would be exposed like that. Do you remember the case of some of David's men, King David, that some of David's, somewhat of his enemies anyway, they pulled that notion where what they did is they took his men, I don't know, there's four or five of them, I don't remember, they shaved half their face, just half their face, and then cut their robe off about the midsection. And they wouldn't even come in to an area. They stayed out there. And David gave the order, you stay out there until your beard grows back, and then you can come in. And why, that was just an act of humiliating them. Yes?
So the picture that we see in children, Bibles, or what have you, where all three men, including Jesus, have briefs or short thumb, that is to dignify the scene for us.
Yes, it is.
All three of the men,
it would have been
totally new.
They would have been. That's again, remember, everything about crucifixion was to be a deterrent, and it was to be the most humiliating thing imaginable to a Jewish man, especially. And we're talking about in a region that's Jewish, so you can understand why they would do that kind of thing. And so humiliate, not only torture, but humiliate the person that's dying. And it's possible for a man to live 3 and 4 days. Before he would succumb to it. It had to do with being able to breathe. You have to pull up. You had to push up with your feet to get a breath. But then the pain would be so excruciating you couldn't hold it, so you'd go back down. But you had to push yourself back up, push and pull at the same time to get the breath out. So you had that writhing constantly in order to catch a breath. Hence, why did they break the legs of the guys on each side of Jesus, the men on each side? They could no longer push up. And when you're hanging like that, it puts your chest in such a contortion, you can't get air in. So they suffocate. And it was, and the Jewish leaders, I smile at this because the irony of all this is just is so astounding. Well, Pilate, we're going to have Passover. We're going to have a feast tonight. We really don't want those men on the cross.
Yeah.
Do something about that. So that's when Pilate gave the order to do that. And that would get them off. And that way you wouldn't be bothered by it. It's kind of like I'm smiling at this because I remember a professor telling this story in a very, very colorful way. Dr. G.H. Surratt, he grew up in somewhere in Mississippi, and he had a way of telling stories. And Dr. Surratt was talking about, in an Old Testament class, are you familiar with Jehu? If you don't know who Jehu was, he became a king of Israel. He followed, you remember Jezebel? Ahab, Jezebel. Anyway, he came roaring in, and kind of you look out the window and from the palace and you see him coming and said, well, that guy's driving a chariot just like Jehu. So you kind of get an idea that he was kind of a wild looking guy. Anyway, he pulls up there. Just prior to his arrival, Jezebel goes in, gets her makeup kit out, proves herself up, gets her hair all combed and all that kind of stuff. I think she knows things are kind of going sour here. And she's talking to him from a window up there. And Jehu said, is there anyone up there for me? Well, there's a couple of servants that did. Said, pitch her down here. So they take her and toss her out the window. I know I shouldn't be laughing like this because this is brutal. He takes his chariot and he runs it back and forth over the top of her. Just does that. Then he goes in and sits down to eat supper. So, brutal, brutal. She comes back and there's only the two things left, her head and her hands. Nothing else. The dogs had eaten everything else. So, That story, bless your heart. probably not very much. So they set him down, they kept watch over him, and they put over his head that placard saying, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." Two robbers were crucified with him. This is not an incidental statement. One on his right, the other on his left. I will take you back many, many weeks. John and James, through their mother, approach Jesus. "We have a request." "Oh," Jesus says, "what's your request?" "That one of these my sons, one is on your set on your right hand, the other on your left, when you enter into your kingdom." Jesus turns to those two young men and says, "You don't know what you ask. Can you be baptized with the baptism that I will be baptized with?" "Oh yeah, sure, sure." And Jesus said, "Well, yeah, you will be, but to be on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give. It's for those that for whom it has been prepared." It's the same wording. It's the exact same wording. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and the other on his left. I don't think James and John would have been so keen about wanting those two places if they understood what those two places truly were. Also accompanied with that is the idea of the glory of his kingdom. Because that was a request. When you come into your kingdom, the glory of your kingdom, let these two sons of mine, one on your right, the other on your left. So when you think about that, it's a bit of a mystery perhaps, and I hope I'm not stretching it too far. Think about, when was this kingdom brought in? When did Jesus ascend to his throne? Now I know later we're talking about the throne, seated at the right hand of God. I know that. It kind of puts a different perspective on the cross. That the cross indeed is an act of glory. Let's, if you want to follow along with me, see if I can find it, because I didn't prepare to do this. In 1 Corinthians, I probably won't be able to find it. Oh, here it is. However, we speak wisdom among those who are mature, yet not the wisdom of this age, nor of the rulers of this age, who are coming to nothing. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew. For had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. So, as shameful, as brutal, as inhumane as the cross, a Roman cross was, in the wisdom of God, it is a cross of glory. Because there a transaction took place that no scholar has ever been able to fully grasp yet, be able to understand or explain. That in the mind and the heart of God, this was the only way sinful men and women could ever be redeemed. See, sometimes we woefully miss We woefully underestimate the seriousness of sin. We don't treat it. We don't think of it in the fullness that we should. But it was only the cross. Only the cross that could remedy that issue. And there a transaction took place. We're getting to that transaction. And we could bring other passages in to help us understand it more clearly. Anyway, the two robbers, one is left, one is right. And those who were passing by blasphemed him, wagging their heads, saying, "You who destroyed the temple and built it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also mocking with the scribes and elders said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him come down and from the cross and we will believe in him." He trusted in God. Let him deliver him. Let God deliver him. If he, that is God, will have him. For he said, "I am the Son of God." Even the robbers, notice the plural there, even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. So they too are hurling these kind of insults at Jesus. Well, I wanted you to notice that both are doing this, but somewhere through this, one of these robbers has a change of heart. When? I don't know. But if we begin taking those statements of Jesus that we find, those seven last statements, among those statements are certain ones that can be might be insightful here. Here he is in a very horrific way, dying on the cross. But he does some things. One thing that he does is he looks at those that are crucifying him, that crucifixion team. Perhaps not just them, maybe some of those in the crowd as well, maybe all of those in the crowd as well. Jesus prays for their forgiveness. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." They do not understand what they're doing. So he does that. I don't know, but that might kind of perk up the ears, at least of one of those robbers. But he does something else too. Now, one of the other things, at least the one I want to point to, is what he said to John. He did something from the cross, in all the agony that he's experiencing, he still does something. And he looks at John, who is the only disciple there. He's probably about 16 years old, most likely, maybe even 15. Mary is there, the mother of Jesus, not Jesus' brothers or any of the family, but John's there beside her. A few other women are there that traveled with Jesus. And he looks at John, he says, "Behold your mother." Then he looks at Mary and he tells her, "Behold your son." What was he doing? What does that mean? Yeah. "John, you take care of Mom." And he did. We're told that from extra biblical sources that he took care of her the rest of her life. Matter of fact, when John went to Ephesus and was there for a period of time, so was Mary. He took care of her. And that's what you... Maybe those two events, and probably some other things too, were what softened the heart of a robber who was being crucified as well. What kind of man does that? Probably most men were screaming curses on those who were torturing them to death and on those who were reviling them, because that was part of the humiliation, to be made fun of. And that might have been just the thing. I think that makes sense to me, because that's not what you expect. Not to expect. We go a little further, and we have a quotation that is very important. And it's coming from Psalm 22. You know Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." Psalm 22, the first line. Matter of fact, if you want to look at a crucifixion passage, that's the one to look at. I mean, look at that. It is vivid. It is more vivid than anything that appears in the New Testament. Anyway, now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, from noon until three, there was darkness over the land. Probably not an eclipse, but that there was dark, which would freak people out, would it not? Sure it did. About the ninth hour, 3 o'clock, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? What happens there at 3 o'clock on that Friday afternoon? John tells us what takes place. You know what takes place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday?
Good night.
No, well, good guess, but no. The priests in the temple are offering the sacrifice. That's what's happening at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The sacrifice is being made. What happens then? Some who heard him, who stood there, heard what he was said, and they say, this man is calling for Elijah. Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed, and offered it to him to drink. And the rest said, let him alone, let's see if Elijah comes. It's obviously people who did not understand the words. Eli, Eli, they thought it meant Elijah, a call for Elijah. It's not. It is just a quotation from Hebrew of that, the first line of Psalm 22. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded his spirit. He died. Which even Pilate is surprised that he's dead this early. And so he yields up the spirit. What did he made a couple of more statements from the cross that John includes. And I think I've looked back, but I think the synoptics do too. One is, in the Greek language, it's just simply one word, tetelestai, which simply means it is finished. It's done. Literally, it means paid in full. Paid in full is what he stated. And then he yielded up his spirit. Something happens. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn. Torn in two from the top to the bottom. And the earth quaked. And rocks were split. Very intense earthquake. Now there are earthquakes in the Middle East. But this one is a bit somewhat unusual. It's splitting rocks. But it does something else. It does something in the temple. Now the temple, the veil of the temple was very thick. I mean, it's not, you know, minuscule like a curtain. It is, I don't forget exactly how thick it is, but it was very thick. And it tore. It tore from the top to the bottom, not from the bottom to the top. And you talk about, even though for us it wouldn't be this way, but for a priest of that day, that would be absolutely horrifying. Because what did the veil of the temple reveal when it tore? The Holy of Holies. Again, this is not just simply symbolic. This is because when you understand that there's only one man that was ever permitted to go in there, and he could not go at will. He could go only once a year in September, and it would be what would be called Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. He would go in there. He'd go in there with a rope tied to his leg. He'd have little pomegranates, golden ones, around the his hem of his robe so they could hear him jingle. Have you ever heard, I'll be there with bells on? They Because that way the people outside could hear him. He's still alive. I can hear him moving around in there. And then if God struck him dead because he went in there unprepared to offer the sacrifice, you can't go get him. But you do have a rope around his ankle. Just pull him out. And you could not have to worry about going in there. But now, from the top to the bottom, that huge curtain rips open. You don't need the high priest anymore. Because you have direct access now not only to the Holy of Holies, but what was in the Holy of Holies? The main piece is the Ark of the Covenant. But what is that? What is the cover called?
Mercy.
The mercy seat. The mercy seat. Human eyes could now see it. Why was that possible? Well, it's possible because Jesus, at 3 o'clock that Friday afternoon, cried out with a loud voice and died. So now, men and women do not have to look for a high priest to go in and make atonement for their sins. You can go directly to the one who is the atoning sacrifice. He is. We're gonna quit on this, and we'll go a little bit further because I know the graves are open, and you want to talk about that too, and that's good. We'll get to that. But I want to teach you a very important word. Some of you are aware of it because it's in your Bibles. Others, it has been changed, and it's the word propitiation. You might say that. Propitiation. What does propitiation mean? It means that person, not only Jesus is a propitiation, it's mentioned like 3 or 4 times in the New Testament. It is, he became not only the atoning sacrifice, sometimes it's translated atoning sacrifice, but it is, he's the one that received the full wrath of God, so you and I don't have to. That's what it means. He became the propitiatory sacrifice. The wrath of God was poured upon him. In one of the songs that the Geddes wrote, we sing it from time to time. We talked about, I'm going to try to remember it, I won't. I can't remember now. I can't remember the exact wording, so I'll just make a stab at it and I'll be wrong. So I apologize for that. But anyway, they have a very good phrase in there. I know what it was. It is the love of God. Oh, the wrath of God was satisfied. That's a propitiation. The wrath of God is satisfied. There was a Presbyterian group that wanted to include that song in their new hymnal. And they wrote to the Geddes asking if they could change the wording. They wanted to say this. That the love of God was magnified instead of the wrath of God was satisfied. And to their credit, the Geddes said, no. No, you're not changing the words. And I'm glad they stuck to their guns because it was theologically correct. Oh, yes, the love of God is magnified. Oh, yes, but that's not the point. Yes, kind of that is part of it, but that is not the major point. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, I've heard the word used before, propitiation, they say mercy seat with it.
Christ, yes, yes. Actually, probably more than you want to know, but Dr. Scribner from Southern Seminary, he wrote a commentary on the book of Romans. Good commentary, by the way. When he comes across the word propitiation, he fought for it in the Christian Standard Bible. You'll find it this way because he did the translating on the book of Romans. And he fought for this when he came across the word of propitiation that would have normally been translated that way. He translated it mercy seat. Now, a lot of people argued with him that I guess he was tenacious enough to fight for what he believed to be the right translation of that. Most people would never associate that, the mercy seat with Jesus. They would not understand that. But, so he's not wrong. It's just that people don't always understand it. Of course, most people don't understand propitiation either. Yes.
So the word substitution, or substitution, is an inadequate rendering of propitiation.
Substitution, well.
Jesus is substituted into the line of cross for the death, whereas we don't. What he did for us, but he did not die for his own sins.
No.
He died for us.
He didn't die as a substitute. A sacrifice was a substitute. So that still works. It doesn't work in the full sense of propitiation, because propitiation is talking about the one who satisfied the wrath of God, that satisfied his wrath. Kind of put it this way, and then I'm going to let you go. On the cross, as a substitute, Jesus died the death that you and I deserve.
Yes.
So in a sense, it wasn't simply Barabbas' cross, it was mine too.
Right.
So he died in my place, because I've sinned, I've broken God's law, I'm under the death penalty, and the wrath of God is going to be focused on me for all eternity, because I have broken God's law. I'm a rebel. So Jesus, in my place, took the punishment I deserve. So he bore the wrath of God, so I don't have to. Now, if someone says, I don't trust Christ, I'm not going to do that, if that be the case, you are, by virtue of doing that, saying, I'm going to take the full wrath of God. And that's why it's eternal. Okay? And we'll talk about that another time. Free to go.